I gave birth to my children in China, in India. They are the sons of migrants born into expatriation. Americans growing up in Asian megacities on the cusp of the Asian century. It wasn't my goal to have children overseas. It just happened that way. I got pregnant when I could and gave birth in the countries where I found myself at the time. I am a journalist and a writer. I didn't want to abandon my work for motherhood, and I didn't. Since my first baby was born, I've written 2 books. This is one of them. I wanted to keep working, and I wanted to have my children. It seemed simple before it began. But then the babies were born. My husband came and went for work, traveling the way I had once traveled, the way we had once traveled together, across the country, around the world, bringing back the grains of roads I'd never walked, the fading ghosts of spice and smoke rising from his skin. I stayed home with my children and my writing and the women who watched our children and cleaned our house so that I could keep writing. These women and I had little in common. They were poor women, brown women, migrant women, and at first I pushed them to the edge of thought. They were important to me primarily because they made me free. I wanted them to be happy. I didn't want to know the details. But that didn't work for long. The women were there. The women were here. We are here together. I understood all too well the functional purpose of our arrangement, but I wasn't sure it made any sense. Nor could I find the mess and nuance of our household reflected faithfully in any medium. Domestic workers are usually depicted in one of a few ways. Essential financial investments made by guilt-free families, scrappy naifs cruelly exploited by the heartless, clueless rich, or, most insidiously, I've come to think, like family. Fundamental female experience is forever reduced to its crudest caricature. Childbirth is screaming, periods are blood, domestic work is a fairy tale. Cinderella, under the thumb of a ruthless stepmother, is finally living the dream when she becomes a benevolent princess with smiling servants of her own. Gradually, I realized that our house was an enclosed landscape of working mothers. That was the basic thing. The most important employees who worked for me, women who shifted my thinking and cleared the way for my work and cared most lovingly for my children, were migrants who'd left their own children behind to work in the city and ended up in my house. We spun webs of compromise and sacrifice and cash, and it all revolved around me. My work, my money, my imagined utopias of one-on-one fair trade that were never quite achieved. When I was a reporter, there existed this cliché about women who covered wars and other humanitarian disasters. They used to say, and we used to say sometimes too, that we were a sort of third gender. We couldn't dream of being men, of course, but we were also exempt from some of the constraints that bound the women we wrote about. We could bare our faces in the street or sit with the men at a segregated dinner. Maybe a commander who would never talk to a woman from his own country might grant us an interview. We were bridges between the tacit maleness of the news organizations that had sent us and the women who were affected by the news, the grieving mothers and the worrying wives. We ourselves were neither here nor there. No matter how much time I spent with a subject, no matter how intimate the interviews became, a yawning space separated me from the people I wrote about. They had one kind of life and I had another. I was tethered to the concreteness of the newspaper and to the abstractions of journalism. The particular troubles faced by women did not affect me, nor did my own personal struggles have anything to do with the women I was interviewing. I was just passing through. After having babies, after raising children in close quarters with women I hired to help, this necessary distance began to warp and melt. I couldn't maintain the sense that I was going along and everything was just fine. It didn't seem fine. Sometimes it seemed crazy. The immediacy of domestic life and the desperation of small humans left few opportunities to question our choices in real time. We stumbled confusedly through a house that was also a job site, grappling with the intimacy of underwear, bathrooms, feeding children, and cuddling them to sleep. Our routines were disrupted by pregnancies, abortions, miscarriages, weddings, domestic violence, funerals, sick children, and school fees. Mine, theirs, the stuff of women the world over. We lived together in the space left by men who were temporarily elsewhere. Men who beat and loved, disappointed and disappeared. The promise of men, the threat of men, the uncertainty of men's actions. We lived those years in China, a rising superpower, and India, an emerging economic engine. These places represent our collective future. They are the stuff of the world's dreams and nightmares. They are also places that have made statistical headway toward erasing women. Female fetuses are aborted. Newborn girls are murdered. Older girls are denied food. Female life is stifled before it can reach womanhood. This systematic erasure of women is not a government initiative, but a wildly popular and only semi-underground grassroots movement. And, of course, women participate. Meanwhile, we, the women who occupied my house, were left to improvise, to endure what we could endure, to become as monstrous as we allowed ourselves to become. Our existence and interplays were literally intramural, between walls, among ourselves. We were not unique. Our private problems are no doubt duplicated in households all over our planet. And yet, housework is seldom considered as a serious subject for study or even discussion. This is an injustice on a grand scale, for housework is everything. It's a ubiquitous physical demand that has hamstrung and silenced women for most of human history. I'd love to believe the struggle for women's equality is concentrated in offices and manufacturing plants, but I've become convinced that this battle takes place, first and most crushingly, at home. When we are saddled with disproportionate work at home, and studies show that virtually all of us women are, particularly during child-rearing years, we are too embarrassed to say so out loud. We don't want to complain. We don't want to tax our romantic partnerships. And in the end, we stand to be blamed. The fact of this disproportionate labor is further evidence of our incompetence. We didn't choose the right partner. We are foolish. We didn't stand up for ourselves. We are weak. We were outmaneuvered in our own homes. We lack tactical skills. It is proof that we are not sufficiently devoted to our children or to our careers, depending upon who's doing the judging. It is proof, and there is ever more proof, that we ourselves are not sufficient. Hiring domestic help is a stopgap and an evasion. The entire model does nothing for the middle class, since only women wealthy enough to pay for domestic help, or women poor enough to regard these jobs in terms of social mobility or survival, are affected. But for those who can afford it, paid domestic help takes the pressure off parents and marriage, off employers and society at large. I have seen online articles prescribing hired household help as a foolproof tonic for marital difficulties and even as the secret to life's happiness. Whether these arrangements provide personal fulfillment and marital bliss to the domestic employees themselves, this detail is never mentioned. I think about all the houses I've known since withdrawing from the world to work at home. I remember the scenes and the stories, and I think somebody should investigate, somebody should write about all of this. But this is my life. If I investigate, I must stand for examination. If I interrogate, I'll be the one who has to answer.